There was one question submitted by Vishnukanta Prabhu about the definition of, or actually Prabhupada's translation of, going back to, it's not 57, it's 56. It's in the previous file. Anyway, the word Nirodha. Prabhupada, in the first verse of chapter 10 of the second canto, translates Nirodha in the list of 10 topics of the Bhagavatam as going back home, back to Godhead. And Jiva Goswami explained it as annihilation. So do the other commentators. And so does Srila Prabhupada in verse 7. When the definition of Nirodha is given, Prabhupada talks about annihilation. So, anyway, Prabhupada's taking liberty in the first verse. He just, I can't tell you exactly why he chose to do that. Prabhupada is, you just have to bear in mind that Prabhupada, his mood is that of a poet rather than a grammarian. He'll sacrifice the grammatical accuracy just to say something that's poetically effective. That's just the way Prabhupada takes liberties. Usually, the literal proper explanation is there. You find it. It's just in the purport or in another verse. I hope that's satisfying to me. I can't question what Prabhupada does. I just try to explain it. Yes, I'm sorry. I don't think so. I don't see how the editors would have made such a radical change. Change from what? What was there? They just obliterated annihilation and turned it into going back home, back to Godhead. I don't know what editor would dare to do that. Okay. Now, summarizing what we just did in set 40 and 57, the list in 56, we read the list of 10 topics, and now the subsequent verses after the first verse of 210, the subsequent verses define each of the 10 topics. These are Suta Goswami's definitions. We went through, I think, the first 4 verses in 57, up to Nirodha and Mukti. Now in 58, we should be continuing, yes, with the last topics, the definitions given in the second canto. So 58, it has just one verse quoted and a few glosses on the words. We did 57, including the commentary. Okay, we did. All right, 58. Abhasascha nirodascha yatostyadyavasiyate sa ashrayat param brahma paramatmeti shabdyate. The next of the 7 verses says, that from which the visible cosmic manifestation and its annihilation are perceived, that's Prabhupada's translation, annihilation, is the supreme fountainhead, not the quarter, the absolute truth known as Brahman and Paramatma. That's also the Vedanta Sutra's definition of Brahman, the absolute truth. Janmadi asya yataha. That from which come the creation, the maintenance and destruction, and so on, of this known universe. So that's just saying it in different words, that from which occurs and also is perceived. The word asti, verb two verbs are there, asti and adyavasiyate. it is, it happens, and also it is perceived. It comes to be known also. In other words, the Supreme Lord is the source of the creation, but he's also the source of all knowledge about the creation. That's Ashraya, the Ashraya, and the Ashraya is identified as Param Brahma, the supreme absolute truth. And you can also call him the Paramatma, the super soul. Okay, now the glosses. This may also be, this is probably from Sridhar Swami. Abhasa Shrishtir Nirodo Layas Cha Yato Bhavat Adyavasiyata Upalabhyate Jivanam Ganendriyeshu Prakashate Cha Sabrameti Paramatmeti Prasiddha Ashrayak Katyate Iti Shabdak Prakarartas Tena Bhagavan Iti Cha Asya Vrittir Agre Vidyaya. The word visible manifestation, abhasa, because abhasa usually is understood to mean the reflection. But we can call, or it's Sudha Goswami who's choosing to call the material creation itself abhasa. It's a reflection of the spiritual reality. It is a reflection. So the word visible manifestation, abhasa, means the sending forth of material creation. And annihilation, nirodha, means the winding up. The entity from whom these processes arise and by whom they are made perceivable to the jiva's senses is the Ashraya, well known as Brahman and Paramatma. So adhyavasiyate doesn't just mean scientific knowledge, philosophical knowledge, and as acquired by experts, but everybody has their ordinary day-to-day perception of the material creation. That awareness that the living entities have of the material creation is coming from the Supreme Lord. The Super Soul is giving them the power to perceive and recognize the material creation. Otherwise, what's the purpose of the material creation? The material creation is for the living entities. If they couldn't perceive it the same way they can't perceive the spiritual world, if they also couldn't perceive the material world would have no purpose. Spiritual world can go on and have its purpose without the conditioned souls knowing about it. There are other people in the spiritual world who know what's going on and are participating. So the conditioned souls in this world, I think it's turned, I'm getting an echo, maybe it's turned up too high. The conditioned souls in the material world are mostly ignorant of the spiritual world. That's okay. That's meant to be. But they have to be cognizant of the material world. Otherwise, it doesn't serve any purpose. They have to see the illusion and experience it and learn their lessons by experiencing the pain that comes with participating willingly in the illusion. So the perception is required. That awareness of the created world is given, is derived from the super soul, the supreme absolute truth. Matak smitir gyanam apohanam cha. Krishna says, from me come knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. From me, functioning in my form as the Paramatma. Okay, I'm sorry, I interrupted Prabhupada, excuse me. Let me begin it again. Or I interrupted Jiva Goswami in the middle. Abhasa Srishti Nirodho Layas Cha Yato Bhavati Ajivasiyata Apulabhyate Jivanam Ganendriyeshu Prakashate Sacha Brahmeti Paramatmeti Prasiddha Ashraya Katyate Iti shabdat prakarartas tena bhagavan iti cha asya vrittir agre videya. The word visible manifestation, abhasa, means the sending forth of material creation. And annihilation, nirodha, means the winding up. The entity from whom these processes arise and by whom they are made perceivable to the jiva's senses is the ashraya, well known as Brahman and Paramatma. This is a quote. Of course, Brahmeti Paramatmeti Bhagavaneti Shabjate, that famous verse. And it doesn't, I'm not indicating in the translation that it is a quote. So therefore, I want to make a mark here. Okay, we should show and put it in quote marks or something. Because we have a reference, that 439 footnote at the bottom of the page tells you that it's Bhagavatam 1327, but we don't have any quote marks around it, so I'll add that. Hear the word thus, the word iti, paramatmeti shabjate, carries the sense of a particular variety. And this implies the idea of the personality of Godhead, Bhagavan. This we intend to fully explain later. Okay, how does a particular variety imply the idea of Bhagavan? What are we talking about there? Anybody have an idea? Prakara is the Sanskrit word. Prakara means kind. Like you can have a lotus, you can have different kinds of lotus. You can have a lotus with so many petals and a lotus with more petals, a lotus with this color, that color, daytime, day blooming lotus light, different kinds, prakaras. So we have Paramatma is a kind of absolute truth, and there's also other kinds like Bhagavan. Yes. Yes. But what prakara means is variety. So that when we say, when we have iti expressing variety or kind, sort, you know, like there's different kinds or different, really different aspects of the absolute truth. So if we put an iti after paramatma, that's, you can take it as implying that there's other aspects also. That's one kind of absolute truth. Another kind of absolute truth, because we have Brahman here and paramatma, those two terms. But we can take it as implied that the third kind is also implied, Bhagavan. Do you agree with that? Or? Okay, but it must be that's, according to grammarians, that's one of the things that he means, prakara. Variety in the sense of kind. You know, varieties of ice cream, different flavors. So different flavors of ashraya. So Brahman, Paramatma, but it's not only two flavors, it's three flavors. The other one is Bhagavan, that's implied. We know from Bhagavatam 1327 that there are three flavors of ashraya. Okay. Three principal flavors, and then you can put nuts on top, whipped cream, and so on. You have different avatars of Bhagavan. Yes? Yeah. The problem with the word variety, I'm marking that right now. I have to puzzle with it, and I'll consult Jayadeva Maharaj. Okay. Because variety is ambiguous. It can mean more than one thing. Variety is the fact that there is variety. And variety can be a particular variety. There's the variety in general, which you don't talk about a variety. There's variety. There's, you know, life is full of variety. And then you can ask, well, what are the different varieties of that ice cream? Those are particular varieties. So the word's ambiguous. It can mean more than one thing.
All this, the Bhagavan is essentially one, but depending on which process we apply to understanding him, he appears as Brahma Paramatma Bhagavan, Gyana Matra Param Brahma Paramatmeshvara Puman, Dishyadibya Prishtak Bhavar. Bhagavat Ekame Iyate. So maybe what is referred to here as prakara is different variety of perceptions of him.
Okay, we're getting off. That's getting off a little bit into a side discussion. But In the context of 1.3.27, we're talking about the tattva. You know, just a generic sense of the absolute truth. And then the absolute truth has three primary aspects. So if we say Paramatma and Brahman, we must be implying the third one, Bhagavan also. Okay? Yeah? Is it something that can't wait? Okay. It can wait. Okay. This we intend to fully explain later. I hope I tell you in the commentary when later. It looks like I don't. Okay, let's read the commentary. Maybe it's hiding there. No, I don't see it. Okay, there's a problem. I like to identify, when I say something's going to be explained later, I like to tell in the commentary where. Why not give the information? Okay, that has to be added. Well, that Vedanti Tattvavidas will be discussed in some detail in the Bhagavad Sandarbha. That's probably where, but I'll find the exact spot. I'm going to read the commentary now. The entire six Sandarbhas are dedicated to explaining the Bhagavatam's tenth and principal theme, the Ashraya. Here, Shukadeva Goswami only hints at the identity of the Ashraya. He completes his characterization in later cantos. Oh, that means later in the Bhagavatam. No. Okay, now it's confusing. Are we talking about later in the Bhagavatam or later in the Sandarbhas? It looks like we, I say we. I think it's Sandarbhas, but it's misleading when I'm talking about the Bhagavatam. Here, Shukadeva Goswami only hints at the ashraya, identity of the ashraya. He completes his characterization in later cantos. Okay. To define... Okay, I'm making a note about that. That sentence may be confusing. It may make the reader think that this agre, this later on, is later on in the Bhagavatam. To define the supreme truth in relation to the material world as the source of its creation, maintenance, and destruction, which is what the Vedanta Sutra does at the beginning and what this verse is doing, but that says little about the full extent of the Lord's glories, especially the opulence and attractiveness of his personality. Nonetheless, our limited modes of thinking in material life dispose us to appreciate more readily the impersonal aspect of the Supreme. Srila Vyasadeva in his Vedanta Sutras 112 first defines Brahman this same way, Janmadyasya Yataha, that from which come the creation and other transformations of this world. As impersonalists become more adept at meditating on the Supreme, they may gradually realize him as the Paramatma localized in their own hearts. In this intermediate realization, the Supreme appears with some of his personal qualities, but does not display the active exchanges of prema bhakti. Because the meditators on Paramatma have only a neutral relationship with him, they do not take part in loving service, friendship, and more intimate relationships. Only the most advanced mystics progress to this full realization of Bhagavan, the personality of Godhead. In the Lord's own words, Bahunam janmanam ante gyanavan mam prapadyate vasudevak sarvamiti samahatma sudurlabaha. After many births and deaths, he who was actually in knowledge surrenders unto me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is. Such a great soul is very rare. Okay. So that's the 10th topic. That, of course, is the focus of interest of the Srimad Bhagavatam. The verse, interestingly, doesn't mention Bhagavan. It only mentions Brahma and Paramatma. And it's curious because this is the Bhagavat Sandarbha, not the Brahma or Paramatma, and the Bhagavat Purana, not the Brahma Purana or the Paramatma Purana. But saying it like this draws the interest of people who are more impersonally inclined. It's a philosophical discussion here of the topics of the Bhagavatam. And philosophers have a tendency to be impersonal thinkers. So, okay, to satisfy, or at least to interest them, it's the discussion, Suta Goswami is talking in more theoretical, impersonal terms here. The absolute truth from which the creation comes and its destruction and its perception, that is the ashraya, the shelter, the supreme absolute truth, who is also called Paramatma, the supreme soul. Paramatma is also a term that the Mayavadis like to use. The supreme soul. But they don't see him as so much as in his personal form within the heart of the living entities. They're thinking of Paramatma as identical with Brahman beyond all duality. The Paramatma in the heart is Saguna Brahman. It's not the original and actual form of Paramatma as far as the Mayavadis are concerned. As far as we're concerned, the Paramatma in the heart is simply an expansion of the Supreme Absolute Truth, but that Supreme Absolute Truth is Bhagavan, as far as we're concerned. And if we talk about Paramatma, we talk about Brahman, they don't exist separately from Bhagavan, according to the Vaishnava Siddhanta. If we're talking about them, then we're talking, at least indirectly, about Bhagavan. Okay. So if you have questions, please don't feel confounded that I'm insisting you have to send it by email. Give it to someone else to send if you can't do it, or just throw a piece of paper on my desk with your question. I'm going to move on to 59. Okay, now we're going to try to understand more about this ashraya tattva, the supreme truth, the shelter of everything. So Sugata Goswami, therefore, for that purpose, continues his discussion. Stitau cha. Did I say Shukadev here? 210. Yeah, this is 210. It is. I earlier in the class I said it was Suta Goswami talking. The commentary correctly says it's Shukadev Goswami talking in the last chapter of the second canto. It's Shukadev. Suta Goswami gives his definition of the 10 topics in the Bhagavatam, a slightly different list, in the 12th canto. The last chapters of the 12th canto, Suta Goswami, Shukadev has already gone away, and Suta continues to speak. 59. Stitau cha tatrashraya svarupam aparoksh anubhavena vyashti dwarapi spashtam darshayetum adhyatmadi vibhagam aha. Yo dhyatmiko yam purusha so sav evadi daivikok yastatrobaya vicheda purusho yari bautika ekam ekatara bhave yada nopalabhamahe tvitayam tatrayo veda sa atma svashrayashrayaha. And to give, within the process of maintenance, a clear indication of the identity of the shelter, ashraya. The divisions of adhyatma and so on are described. in the final two of the seven verses. This is done through a meditation on manifestly visible phenomena, involving again the individual living beings, Vyashti. Okay, what goes on in the life of the individual living beings in the material world? This certainly is within the under the heading of Stiti, among the ten topics. General maintenance. The Supreme Lord makes arrangements for the material life of the conditioned souls, gives them bodies, puts the demigods to work, and arranges the whole system of material existence. That's Stiti, general maintenance. Okay, the translation of the two verses. This Adhyatmika Purusha is the same jiva as the Adhidaivika Purusha. And the source of for the distinction between the two, these two, is called the Adhibhautika Purusha. In the absence of any one of these, we do not perceive the other two. The Supreme Lord is he who knows all three. Independent of all else, that Lord is his own support and the true Ashraya. I wonder whether there should be Supreme Soul. Prabhupada said Supreme Lord in his translation. But we're not using the term Bhagavan. Shukadeva is intentionally talking in less personal terms. Maybe we should just say Supreme Soul. That would change Prabhupada's translation, but it fits more the context of Jivadutta Goswami's discussion here. I made a note about that, whether the change here Supreme Lord to Supreme Soul. Because the verse just says Atma. In fact, you could argue that we're talking about the Jivatma. I think Jiva Goswami is going to defeat that suggestion, but it could be made. Now, what we're talking about here is three different purushas, three different concepts of person, or three different aspects of personal life and material world. And all three must be present and work together. You can't have material life without having all three. And the first thing it said is that the first two, the Adhyatmika and the Adhidaivika Purushas, they're the same jiva. Well, okay, the individual who's experiencing material life, he's controlled by demigods. But those demigods are also individual jivas. So the demigods are just jivas. That's what we mean when we say they're the same jiva. The Adhyatmika Purusha is a jiva, and the demigod is a jiva, but they're in different roles. One of them is receiving, one is being controlled, and the other one is controlling. And then, what makes the difference? What's the difference between a controlled jiva and a controlling jiva? You can say the fact of being controlled, but what Shukadev says is that the presence of the third purusha, the physical body, the material body, that is what distinguishes. When we have material bodies involved, then we have a distinction between the person who's identifying with the material body and using it and the controlling demigods, how they relate to the body. I relate to my body. It's my body. I only have one body, and nobody else has my body. No one else is conscious of my body. That's on the adhyatmic level. But on the adhidaivic level, the demigod is aware of all the bodies in his own department of control. He may be in control of one finger, but he knows that finger in every single body in the universe. So that's when you put in between the physical body, then you have a real distinction between jiva and demigod, ordinary jiva and demigod. If there were no material bodies, then the demigods would be out of business. There'd be nothing to control. They'd just be back in the position of being ordinary jivas again. That's what it means, that in the absence of any of these three, we do not perceive the other two. Who is it that knows all three? That's the Atma, the Supreme Self. He's independent of everything else. He's his own support, and he's the true ashraya. Now, you can say that the jiva soul is conscious of all three. Not always, only if he's self-realized. And you can't say that he's his own support and he's the ashraya of everything else. That you cannot say about the individual jiva. So even though the word is atma, which could be taken either way, swashraya ashraya, he's the ashraya who's his own ashraya, that cannot apply to the individual jiva, only to the supreme soul. So atma there must mean the supreme soul in the context. Okay. Then there's another half of this, that the gloss on this, these two verses. 59.2. Yoyam adhyatmikak purushas chakshuradi karanabhimani drashta jiva sa ev adi daivakas chakshurad adishtata suryadi dehek shrishtek purvam karananam adishtanabhavena kshamataya Kanana prakasha kartvit rabhimani tatsahayo yor ubayor abitayor vitibed anudayena jivatva matra visheshat. This adhyatmika person, the jiva who identifies himself as the owner of, for example, the visual sense, also assumes the role of the adhidaivika person. In this example, the demigod of the sun and the other presiding deities of sight. Before the creation of the material body, the senses are unable to function, having no place to reside. And so the different functions of the two purushas, one presuming to activate the senses with consciousness, the other making this activation possible. Is that okay? The finite conditioned soul is presuming to activate his senses with consciousness. He thinks he's the knower and the performer of activity in his own body. Because he has knowledge-acquiring senses and active senses. And the jiva is thinking that he's the proprietor and controller of both. So he's presuming to activate his senses with consciousness. How do you activate your senses? There may be a mechanism. There may be nerve fibers and a muscle system, but the jiva doesn't deal with those directly. He's not conscious of them most of the time. He's just thinking and things happen. I want to move my finger, it moves. So he's activating just by consciousness. Okay. Thus, let's see. Continuing. Thus, the two remain indistinguishably jivas and nothing more. Did I skip something? Okay, before the material bodies are created, the senses are unable to function. And these two different functions of the two purushas, one presuming to activate the senses with consciousness, the other making this activity possible, have not yet appeared. Without a body, there's no such system in place. Thus, until the body is created, the two, the jiva and the demigod, remain indistinguishably jivas and nothing more. Then continuing the Sanskrit. Tatas chobayo chobaya karanabhimani tadadishtratvi devata rupo dvirupo vichedo yasmat sa adibhautikas chakshur golokyad upalakshito drishyo deha purusha iti purushasya jivasya upadhi sa va esha purusho anarasamaya ityadi shrutehe.
Hare Krishna. Let me just check one thing.
Obaya vicheda. I wonder if that should be obayo, genitive dual. I have obaya. Is obaya correct form? Yes, it is. It would be nominative. I think it's not nominative here. I think it should be genitive dual. I'll check the text. Oh, boy. At least we're catching them now. At least we're catching these mistakes before it's too late.
Okay, translation of that.
Later, the Adibhautika person appears, by whom the other two persons become divided into separate identities. The claimed proprietor of the sense and the presiding deity of the sense. He claims, Jiva claims to be proprietor of his senses. And the demigods actually officially the presiding deity of that sense. This Adibhautika person is the visible body, represented by the eyeball and the other physical sense organs. He is regarded as a person in that he is an upadhi of the jiva. As stated in the Shruti text, this person is made of food and bodily fluids. Yeah, the body is not a person. It's a lump of matter. But he's an upadhi. He's a, let's say, covering designation or a false identity of the jiva. So by extension, metaphorically, he's a person, not literally. He's metaphorically, figuratively a person, the physical body. And the Taittiriya Upanishad is talking in those terms about the five koshas, talks about five different kinds of purusha. The first purusha is the one that's made out of flesh and blood, or food and bodily fluids, anna and rasa. The second one is the mental person. The third one is the second one is the pranic person, made of prana. Then the third one is the one made of mind. Then the fourth one is the jiva. And the fifth one is the paramatma. These are five different purushas. Only two of them, the jiva and paramatma, are real persons. The other ones are just figuratively persons or coverings of the jiva. Okay, let's see what the commentary says. Yes? Reference.
It's supposed to be 447, I think, if it matches the translation.
No, don't worry about those numbers. The numbers that show up in the translations are out of sync. I'm going to redo them, but first of all, we're going to eliminate some comments, some of those footnotes. There's some references that are going to go out because we couldn't find the verse numbers. It says in the text, Jiva Goswami says, as is said in the Matsya Purana, and then if I can't find the verse reference, then all I'm going to be able to say in the footnote is Matsya Purana. There's no need to do that. In that case, I'm going to delete the comment, and that affects the footnote numbering. So until all that's settled and we make the final changes, there's no more changes in the footnotes. I'm not going to fix up the numbers in the translations. See, the word only generates footnote, one set of footnote or automatic footnote numbers. I'm duplicating them in the translation. I have to do that mechanically by hand. So they're all out of sync. Okay. Commentary. In the transcendental realm of Vaikuntha, every living being is always joyful, free from limits and defects. In that realm, moreover, the all-powerful, all-blissful personality of Godhead is ever present to everyone, sharing various loving exchanges with his devotees. In Vaikuntha, there is no need for the contrived arrangements that allow the embodied souls to pursue the exploitation of matter, arrangements that must be constantly maintained by regulating demigods. Material life is extremely complicated. As modern biochemists have discovered, for example, the unconscious and seemingly effortless process of digesting a meal involves hundreds of chemical reactions with hundreds of different enzymes and long chains and cycles of intermediate byproducts. All of this needing to be orchestrated to a fine precision for digestion to succeed. Biologists have identified organic chemicals and minerals and their complex interactions, but have hardly considered who might have designed this elegant intricacy, and whether higher intelligences might be at work even now to inspire and direct the so-called automatic life processes that go on in every living being. Processes of which the owners of the bodies are only slightly aware. The Vedas and texts derived from them reveal how the higher controllers, the King of Heaven and his colleagues, such as the demigods of the sun, wind, and fire, influence the processes of life. The medical science of Ayurveda, for instance, points out the essential influence of the demigod of fire in the process of digestion. The biochemist can tell you how there is a complex cycle of citric acid synthesis and breaking down. The citric acid turns into something, you know, in order to one step in hundreds of steps in digesting your food is that the citric acid has to turn into one chemical, that turns into another chemical and goes around a ring of six chemicals and comes back to citric acid. And you maintain a balance of the presence of this chemical or that chemical in your digestive system. And if the balance is wrong, the digestion goes wrong. That's just one of thousands of different chemical reactions involving very complex organic chemicals. So the modern scientists know all about that. But in Ayurveda, we learn about the essential influence of the demigod of fire in the process of digestion. That the biochemists don't know about. Without the right Agni Samskara, or grace of fire, food cannot properly digest, and this results in disease. The demigods Indra, Surya, Vayu, Agni, and the others are the deities worshipped by the hymns of the Rig Veda. The most confidential parts of Vedic literature, however, further reveal these very gods to be creatures of the Supreme Lord. Like the mortals they dominate, they are finite living beings, although unlike ordinary mortals, they have been specially empowered by their Lord to assume universal controlling functions. As Suta Goswami points out, in the verses cited in this Anuchet, Suta or Shukadev? It's Shukadev. We had a Shukadev in the previous Anuchet. What a mess. Shukadev. It's Shukadev, right? It's still Shukadev speaking, right? Not Sutta. As Shukadev points out, I said Suta Goswami, wrong. As Shukadev Goswami points out in the verses cited in this Anuchet, the Adhyatmika person, the controlled embodied soul, is the same as the Adidaivika person, the controlling demigod, in the sense that both are in the same category of individual spirits, soul, jiva. They differ merely in the roles they play as controllers and controlled. The third person of the material triad, the Adibhautika, is different from the other two because so-called he, he's not really a he, is the inert material body with its organs and senses. Of course, this third person is still needed for material life to function. Without the so-called living bodies, the mortals have no means to try to enjoy, and the deities have nothing to rule. Shukadev Goswami concludes his statement by saying that above these three material persons is the ultimate person, the shelter of all, beyond whom there is no other shelter. The supreme person knows fully the three persons of material life, and he is their ultimate controller. Teaching us to know and become attracted to him is the main purpose of Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the most perfect distillation of the teachings of the Vedas. All other discussions in Srimad Bhagavatam are meant only to serve this main purpose. So it's not that Shukadev Goswami is giving us a course on biology. No, that's not. We're not interested in that for its own sake. But it's a means of understanding who this ashraya is. What's his function? He's got his function in the spiritual world, Krishna, the supreme shelter, in the loving dealings of him and his devotees. He's got his purpose in the material world, and that is easier for us to understand. We're of the material world, and our creation is dependent on and completely maintained by that ashraya. That's what these verses are talking about. And that's why it's relevant to the discussion of the Tattva Sandarbha.
Okay, I'm going to stop here.
It's what, 9 minutes to?
I marked it twice.
I know it's a mistake twice.
Okay, we'll stop here and we'll start the Kavya class at 10 minutes after. Please come on time at 10 minutes after 10. Okay, thank you. All glory to Srila Prabhupada. Sri Tattva Sandarbha Ki Jai.